Welcome back to the program. Why is it so hard to lose weight, to quit smoking, to go to the gym regularly? Much of the answer lies in the power of habits. The same habits that allow us to back out of the driveway every morning without conscious thought and to brush our teeth each day without using too much mental energy also often stand in the way of our progress. This is the power of habits. And it's the title of a new book by our guest Charles Duhigg. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times, a winner of the George Polk Award, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and recently gave us so much insight into the Chinese factories that are turning out so many of the electronic goods that we use every day. It is my pleasure to welcome Charles Duhigg to the program to talk about his new book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Charles Duhigg, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Good to have you here. Many years ago, I was it was a Friday afternoon. I was making a drive that I did every Friday afternoon for years and years. This was in Southern California, and suddenly found myself four exits past where I was supposed to get off and had no idea how I got there. In many ways, I've never understood that. Now I have a clearer understanding of it as being part of the power of habit.
That's exactly right. What we've learned in the last decade is that the neurology of how habits work. And this has completely transformed our understanding of how habits form in our lives, how they change, why they emerge in the first place. And what we've learned is that every single habit has the same three-part structure. We refer to this as the habit loop. There's a cue, which is a trigger for an automatic behavior to start unfolding. Then a routine, which is the behavior itself. And then finally, a reward. And within our neurology, that cue and that reward become intertwined until a sense of craving emerges that you might not even be aware of. But that's what powers a habit.
And part of this is that evolution seems to have given us this so that it frees up more of our brain power for the important decision-making stuff that we have to focus on.
That's exactly right. It's really important that we have this capacity to sort of think about things while acting, right? I mean, take backing your car out of the driveway, for instance, which is a great example. When you back your car out of the driveway, the first time you did it, it took a lot of mental energy. But nowadays, you can pretty much do that without thinking about it. And that means that you can think about the meeting coming up later that day, you can talk to your kids, you can play with the radio. It's really important from an evolutionary perspective that our brain develop the ability to automate certain behaviors so that rather than thinking all the time about what we're going to have for dinner that night or how we put one foot in front of the other, we can invent spears and fire and then eventually video games and aircraft carriers.
Of course, the other side of that coin is that several months ago, my wife backed her car out of the driveway on autopilot, and even after seeing that there was another car in the way, forgot about it.
That's right. That's the downside of habits, right? Is that the upside is that it kind of automates stuff for us. The downside is that our brain literally stops working as we're in the middle of a habit. We stop thinking. And so as a result, we become essentially blind to all of the normal signals that would say, quit backing the car up. Or even more so, we lose kind of that willpower, right? Which is why when you see a box of donuts on the counter at work, even if you weren't hungry 10 minutes before, all of a sudden you see those and it becomes almost uncontrollable to stop yourself from grabbing one and eating it. It's because you're not actually thinking.
And what is the nexus between that kind of automatic reaction and then what we often do at the same time, and the donuts are a good example, where we then rationalize, okay, I'll have the donut, but spend an extra half hour at the gym?
The nexus there, I think that basically we're trying to do a mental calculus, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what we know is that it's hard for that calculus to actually work out. I mean, what's much easier is to change your habits so that you don't eat the donut and you go to the gym. From studies of people who have lost a lot of weight or who have gotten in shape later in life, what we know is that the people who are successful at that, particularly with the people who lose weight and keep it off,
mm-hmm.
are people who don't make decisions about what they eat anymore. They don't make decisions to exercise. The behavior has become automatic. Because we only have so much willpower every day. Willpower is like a muscle. If you tire it out, it disappears. And so the key is to focus on those moments that you normally would need to use willpower and to make those decisions into habits because habit doesn't take any willpower at all.
In many ways, it's using one habit to replace another. Instead of having that donut or that chocolate chip cookie every day, maybe we have a bottle of water every day or a yogurt every day.
That's exactly right. And in fact, what we've learned is, as I mentioned before, there's this habit loop, right? The cue, the routine, and the reward. And what we've learned is that if you want to change a habit, you have to focus on the cue and the reward. You can't make habits disappear. Once a habit is ingrained in your neurology, it'll be there for years. But what you can do is you can alter it. You can build up a new neurological pathway that says, okay, here's the cue that I'm used to, and here's the reward that I need, but I'm going to change how I behave. And once you change that habit, then you have control over your behavior.
Explain your example with that, with the cookie that you would get every day, and how you did some experiments on your own to try and figure out where that reward really was.
Yeah, so I had this bad habit when I started writing this book of having a cookie every afternoon, a chocolate chip cookie. I work at the New York Times. I would go up to the cafeteria. And when I was talking to psychologists and to neurologists and reporting this book, I would ask them, so tell me, how can I fix this cookie habit? And what they said was, you have to pay attention to the cue and the reward and change the routine. So I started with the cue. I kept notes about sort of when I had this cookie urge, and every cue we know from studies falls into one of five categories. Usually, it's usually either a place, a person, a time of day, a certain emotion, or a sort of ritualized behavior. And I kept notes on all those five things, and I realized the cookie urge always hit me between 3:15 and 3:45. Then I started paying attention to the reward, and I did some experiments. I was trying to figure out, was the cookie the reward that I was really searching? So one day I'd go up to the cafeteria, instead of having a cookie, I'd have an apple. And the next day I had a cup of coffee. And then the next day I went for a walk instead of going up to the cafeteria. Basically trying to figure out what besides a cookie could satisfy my cookie urge. And what I figured out was the reason I was going up to the cafeteria every afternoon wasn't for the cookie. It was because it offered me socialization. I could gossip with some of my colleagues up in the cafeteria. The cookie was just a convenient excuse. And once I had identified that cue and that reward, I was able to change my habit. And now, every day at about 3:30, I stand up and I look around the newsroom and I find a colleague to go gossip with, and I go over and I gossip with them for 10 minutes. And then I go back to my desk, and it's automatic, and the cookie urge has completely disappeared. And I've actually lost a bunch of weight since then.
What do we understand about why it's so hard to change the routine aspect of it in the middle? I mean, you indicate, you know, that can stay with us for years. Why is that so tough, and how do those routines form initially?
Well, those routines form because over time we come to associate a certain behavior with a certain reward. And the reason why it feels so hard to change the routine or the behavior is because we've grown accustomed to getting these rewards that we crave from a certain habit. So the donut example is a great one, right? You might have had a great lunch or a great breakfast, and you're not hungry when you get to work. But when you see that donut box sitting on the counter, what your brain starts to say is, oh, I've come to associate that box, the cue of that box, with eating a donut, and this blast of sugar, this pleasurable mental response I get, the reward of a yummy taste and the sugar high. And so your brain actually not only starts anticipating that pleasurable experience of eating the donut as soon as it sees the box, it begins experiencing it. We know this from brain studies, that you can start to see the pleasure response actually already unfold the moment you see that box of donuts. What's dangerous, though, is that if that pleasure response kind of tapers off, if the expectation isn't fulfilled, then a craving emerges. And that craving is what makes it feel so compelling to go over and pick up the donut. That craving is why the habit unfolds. And that's why these routines seem so powerful, is because once we're under the sway of that craving, it's very, very hard to shift it, unless you can find something else that delivers the same reward. Then your brain satisfies that craving, but with a new behavior.
Talk about how we're understanding more about this from brain studies that have been done and functional MRIs and what we're seeing in terms of how the brain fires in these situations.
Well, it's really interesting. Our capacity to sort of observe brains in action has completely transformed our understanding. And in fact, that's why in the last decade we say that our understanding of habits has been sort of, completely changed upside down. And we now know how to create habits and how to change habits. One of my favorite studies was done by a guy named Reza Habib, and he was looking at gamblers. What he wanted to understand was why do some people seem to have gambling habits that they feel compelled by and other people don't? So he took two groups of people. Some of them were problem gamblers. These are people who had already lost a lot of money, who had lied to their family about their gambling, who had had bad debts. The other group were people who had gambled occasionally but didn't have any problems with it. And he put them inside both groups inside a functional MRI that would take pictures of the blood flow and through their brain as they thought and watched things. And in front of the machine was a video screen that showed a slot machine. And the slot machine was programmed to give three outcomes. One was a win, one was a loss, and one was a near win, which means the people actually lost, but all the little sevens or all the little cherries almost lined up. And what Reza Habib found was that when non-problem gamblers, when normal people watch this, they recognized that a near miss was in fact a loss. Their brain responded just as if they had just lost their money.
Mm-hmm.
People who were problem gamblers saw a near miss as a win. Sort of this theory that their brain responded by triggering the gambling habits that were triggered also whenever they won. And this means that basically two groups of people saw the exact same thing and reacted completely differently. They saw something completely differently. One of them had a habit triggered and the other didn't. And this helps explain why, from a neurological perspective, people who have gambling problems seem to react so differently in a casino.
One of the other things that you talk about is the way these habits work in the context of a group dynamic, that there are companies that develop habits over time, and those things become inculcated in a way that develops a kind of corporate culture.
That's exactly right. And one of my favorite stories about this is Paul O'Neill, who was the CEO of Alcoa. Most people probably know Paul O'Neill because he was Treasury Secretary in the Bush administration. But before that, actually the way that he sort of came to prominence and why he became Treasury Secretary is that he took over Alcoa, which was then the largest aluminum company in the world. It's a huge corporation, offices all over the world. People who work at Alcoa work with literally molten metal. It's very dangerous work. And when Paul O'Neill came in, everyone expected him to say that he was going to transform the company by focusing on profits and efficiency and pushing people to work harder. But instead, what he said when he came in was, "My number one priority is changing worker safety habits," which, of course, to shareholders was kind of shocking and a little bit concerning because they expected him to say, "We're going to become more profitable." And instead he said, "My goal is to get to zero injuries," which is a fairly audacious goal for a company where people handle molten metal. But what Paul O'Neill knew, and he explained this to me, was that some habits matter more than others. That some habits, when you start changing them within an organization, it sets off a chain reaction. And within science, these are referred to as keystone habits, habits that have this power to kind of unlock all of the patterns and all of the behaviors within an organization. Paul O'Neill knew that for Alcoa, worker safety was a keystone habit, that by changing the habits around worker safety, he would be able to transform the entire company, not only how they treat each other with regards to safety, but how employees work, how employees and managers communicate, how work gets done. And he was exactly right. Within 2 years of taking over, Alcoa became the best performer in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. He just completely changed the company.
And the other side of that is that we hear so often how difficult it is to change the culture of companies because the effort is usually made to change it the wrong way.
That's exactly right. Because most of the time when a new CEO comes in, they sort of order. It's a top-down structure to try and change the culture. But when you talk to really good CEOs, people like Paul O'Neill or Lou Gerstner at IBM, who did the IBM turnaround, or Jack Welch at GE, they don't talk about issuing orders. What they talk about is changing corporate habits, because they know that our life is actually made up, and a corporation's life is made up of dozens or hundreds of small choices that are made by thousands of different people each day, right? I mean, this is true for people's lives. It doesn't matter what you have for lunch today, but what you have for lunch every day matters a lot. And it doesn't matter how, you know, we set up one particular reimbursement program or what it says in a handbook, but the way that employees and managers communicate every day on a habitual level, that matters a lot. So when good CEOs come in, what they say is, I want to focus on changing the habits of this organization, because I know that by doing so, I will transform the entire culture.
It's interesting, because there's a lot of talk about this, too, in the medical community, that to the extent that we do things that are habitual, eat at the same time every day, take a walk at the same time, do those things, that in some ways it creates less stress on our system and therefore is healthier, as opposed to eating at a different time every day or doing things differently every day, or people that are pilots, for example, that are always on a different time zone. It creates more internal stress.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I think one of the things that you find about successful people is that they tend to routinize their behaviors with good routines. They pay attention to what those routines are, right? In the book, we talk about one of the examples is Michael Phelps, who, when I talked to Michael Phelps' coach, and I asked him why Phelps is so successful, what he said was that Michael Phelps has created the right habits, not only training habits, but also the right mental habits. So every single day for Michael Phelps is essentially the same as the one that came before and the one after. He has these very established routines that he follows, and the whole goal is to basically get him into a mindset, particularly on a race day, where he already feels like he's winning by the time the race comes along. So when he wakes up at the exact same time, he has the breakfast that he always has. He stretches the exact same way. He does the exact same number of warm-up laps. He listens to the same hip-hop mix. Every step of that day feels like a small win, because it's unfolding exactly as he planned, which means that by the time he gets to the race, it's just one more small win in a series of small victories throughout the day. There's actually a lot of academic research about this called the science of small wins. And what it tells us is that when people develop good routines, deliberate routines, when they think about what they eat or how they work, they tend to be much, much more successful, because it gives them the mental space to kind of, A, think about what else is going on, but B, conduct little experiments to learn what works and what doesn't work in a day. You can only get into that mindset where you can kind of be hyper-observant about what makes you successful when you don't have to think about what you're doing all the time.
Mm-hmm. The other side of that is that if we have bad habits that we're looking to change, getting out of our routine, be it a vacation, be it a new job, what have you, is the ideal way to go.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, we know that if you there's these really interesting studies about, for instance, how people brush their teeth and put on their shoes. So most people probably give zero thought to how they brush their teeth or put on their shoes. But I guarantee you, everyone does it the exact same way that each morning. You might do it differently from your neighbor, but you yourself do the same thing every single day. If you put on your left shoe first or your right shoe first, you always do it the exact same way, unless you go on vacation. When you're on vacation, all of a sudden, your patterns will change, probably in ways you don't even notice. You might brush your teeth after getting out of the shower instead of before getting in the shower. You might put on your right shoe first instead of your left shoe first. What we know is that when people go on vacation, when they travel, their cues start to change. They're in an unfamiliar environment, and so their habits become more flexible, even if they're not aware of it, which means, by the same token, that oftentimes if you want to change a really ingrained behavior, one of the best ways to do it is when you're on vacation. And we know this from people who've quit smoking, that one of the easiest ways to kick off giving up cigarettes is to give them up when you go on vacation.
The other side of that is the way in which these habits become so actualized within us that oftentimes we say, if we start a new job or it's a new relationship or a new situation or moving to a new town, whatever it may be, that provides the opportunity to change those habits, we say, we're going to change this, we're going to change that, we're going to change this. And yet the tendency is to take that new situation and fall back into the same habits.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's exactly right. But, you know, I think one of the things that happens is that people try and take on too much change at once. So this is something that we've learned, particularly from weight loss studies, that conventional wisdom 10 years ago was, if you want to lose a lot of weight, change everything at once. Remove all the cues that used to trigger your overeating. And that would work for a week or two, and then it would just be too much. It was too much change at the same time. What we know now is that change is a gradual process, and that the best way to make it sustainable is to allow people to gradually change and find ways that their change works. Food journals for exercise is one of the best, for weight loss is one of the best examples. One of the most successful studies in getting people to lose weight asked them to start by just writing down one day a week what they ate that day. And actually, what the researchers, they didn't think it would change anyone's behavior. They just wanted to keep track of what people were eating. But what they found was that some of the people would start writing down, you know, one day a week what they ate. And then eventually they started writing down 2 days and 3 days. The food journaling became a habit. And when it did, all of a sudden the people who started food journaling, they started using those journals to also create plans for what they were going to eat that night. So when they got home from work and they were exhausted, rather than ordering takeout, they would look inside their food journal and say, oh, I'm supposed to have chicken tonight. They would find these little patterns. Like, they always noticed that they were writing down that they got hungry at 10:30 in the morning. So rather than wait till they got hungry, they put some apples on their desk so they had a healthy alternative. By doing this gradual process of change, people were able to sort of revolutionize their eating. And those people who food journaled lost twice as much weight as anyone else and kept it off for months and, in many cases, years, because the process of change was this gradual one where they found the patterns within their own lives.
And, of course, one of the interesting things you've written about and gotten a lot of attention for is the way some companies have taken all of this scientific information and created metrics around it and have used it to market things to us.
That's exactly right. Target's the best example of this, right? And I wrote a piece in the New York Times Magazine that was an excerpt from the book about how Target does this. Target studies shoppers' habits in order to try and figure out, in particular, which customers are pregnant. Because they know that if they can find pregnant customers, they can start sending them coupons and get them to buy what they need at places like Target. So there's this real science of companies studying shopping habits, of appealing to shopping habits, diagnosing the cues and the rewards that shoppers are craving so that they can then use that information to shop, to sell things to people that that they might not otherwise want to buy.
And in fact, to the extent that you can quantify this and create metrics around these habits, we haven't quite figured out a way that we can use that for our own advantage yet.
Well, right. It's hard, but there's a lot out there to help us do it, right? There, for instance, I when I go running, I use something called Nike Plus that basically tracks all of my miles, it tracks my pace, it tracks when I go running. You can even get a GPS component so it can tell me where I went running and how my pace changed. If you start collecting data on your own life, you can start figuring out your own patterns. But you don't really need that data. I mean, most people kind of know what their habits are, right? We all have an intuitive sense of what the behaviors are that feel automatic, that we wish that we didn't do, or other behaviors that we wish were easier. And once you identify those patterns in your life, if you start diagnosing the cue and the reward, then you can start changing them. And in the book, we go into this in a lot of detail, how to change habits, how to create new habits. But the one thing that I've carried away is any habit can be changed. Any habit can be created. It doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter how ingrained that behavior is. What we've learned in the last 15 years about the neurology of habits tells us that any of them can be changed.
And the ideal is, as Paul O'Neill did at Alcoa, trying to find what those keystone habits are.
That's exactly right. Find keystone habits in your own life. Change those, and the rest of everything else will kind of unfold on its end.
Charles Duhigg, the book is The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Charles, it's been a pleasure. I thank you so much
for
spending
time
with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.